Am I daft?
What's daft about it? For someone has to do it, don't they?
Jack doesn't think it's a good idea.
And what does that matter? He's not your wife, is he? You can make your own decisions.
I don't know if they'd even take me on.
But Jack doesn't want to stay on at Guinness's forever either.
He has an idea for his own pub.
That's just what Dublin needs. Another pub.
Not here. In Amsterdam.
What?
Asked my mother, raising her voice in surprise.
Sure, why would he want to go there?
I suppose it's the Dutch side of him, said Sean.
He's never been, but he's heard great things about the place. What kind of things?
That it's different to Ireland.
Well, that can hardly come as a great revelation. There's canals and the like there, isn't there? Different in other ways than that.
He said nothing more, and my mother began to worry that he'd fallen asleep and slipped beneath the surface of the water.
I have a bit of news myself, she told him,
hoping that he'd answer quickly or she'd have no choice but to turn around.
Go on, so. I have an interview for a job tomorrow morning.
You do not.
I do,
she said as he splashed away again, using the small bit of soap that she'd picked up from a market stall a few days earlier and presented to Smoot, partly as a gift for allowing her to stay and partly as encouragement for him to have a wash.
Good girl yourself, said Sean. Where is it anyway?
The Doll.
The what? The Doll, on Kildare Street, you know, the Parliament building. I know what the Doll is, replied Sean, laughing. I'm just surprised, that's all. What class of a job is it at all?
Are you to be a TD? Are we to have our first female Taoiseach?
I'd be serving in the tea room. I'm to meet a Mrs. Hennessy at 11 o'clock, and she's going to give me the once-over.
Well, that's a bit of good news, anyway. Do you think you'll...
A key in the lock.
It stuck for a moment, was taken out and reinserted, and when my mother heard Smoot walking into the other room, she moved over a little on the bed so that he wouldn't notice her sitting there, her eyes resting on the crack in the wall that looked like the journey of the River Shannon through the Midlands.
"Here you are,"
he said, using a tender sort of voice that she had never heard him employ before.
"Now there's a fine sight to return home to."
"Jack!"
snapped Sean immediately. His tone different too, quick to silence him.
"Catherine's inside."
My mother turned around on the bed and glanced towards the front room at the same moment that Smoot looked across. And her glance, she told me afterwards, was torn between the fine bare chest on Sean, muscled and hairless as he lay in the dirty water, and the face on Smoot, which was growing more annoyed by the second. Confused, uncertain what mistake she'd made exactly, she turned back around, glad to hide her blushing face.
"Hello, Jack,"
she cried cheerfully.
"Kitty?"
"Back from the slog?"
He said nothing, and there was a long silence from the living room, and my mother longed to turn around to see what was going on. The two boys weren't talking aloud, but even in the silence she could tell there was some class of a conversation going on between them, even if it was only through the way that they looked at each other. Finally, Sean spoke.
"Catherine was just telling me that she has a job interview in the morning, in the tea room of the Doll, if you can believe it."
"I believe anything she tells me," said Smoot. "Is this right, Kitty? Will you be joining the ranks of the working women at last? Christ alive, there'll be a United Ireland next."
"If I give a good account of myself," said Catherine,
ignoring his sarcasm.
"If I impress the manageress, then hopefully the job will be mine."
"Catherine," said Sean, raising his voice,
"I'm getting out now, so don't turn around. Sure, I'll close the Doll together and leave you to dry yourself. Do you need fresh clothes?"
"I'll get them,"
said Smoot, walking into the bedroom and taking Sean's trousers from the back of a chair and a fresh shirt, underwear and socks from the dresser drawer, which he held in his hands for half a minute while staring down at Catherine, daring her to look up at him, which eventually she did.
"Will they not have a problem, do you think?" he asked. "The lads in the Doll."
"With what?"
she asked, noticing how he held Sean's clothes protectively in his arms. The boy's smalls to the fore as if he wanted to intimidate her with them. "With that," he said, pointing towards my mother's stomach.
"I bought a ring,"
she replied, holding her left hand and showing it to him.
"That's well for those with money. And what about when the child is born?"
"I have a great plan for that,"
she said.
"So you keep saying. Will you ever tell us what it is, or do we have to guess?"
My mother said nothing, and Smoot walked away.
"I hope you get it,"
he muttered as he passed her, quiet enough so only the two of them could hear. "I hope you get the bloody job, and then you can get the fuck out of here and leave us both in peace."
An interview at Dáil Éireann. When my mother arrived at the Dáil the following morning, the wedding ring was clearly visible on the fourth finger of her left hand. She gave her name to the guard as standing on duty at the front door. A sturdy-looking individual, whose expression suggested there were 100 places he would rather be than there, and he consulted a clipboard of the day's visitors before shaking his head and declaring that she wasn't on the list.
"I am,"
said my mother, leaning forward and pointing at a name next to 11 o'clock for Mrs. C. Hennessy.
"That says Gorgon," said the gardener. "Catherine Gorgon."
"Well, that's just a mistake," said my mother. "My name is Goggin, not Gorgon."
"If you don't have an appointment, I can't let you in."
"Garda," said my mother, smiling sweetly at him, "I assure you that I am the Catherine Gorgon whom Mrs. Hennessy is expecting. Someone has merely written my name down incorrectly, that's all."
"And how am I to know that?"
"Well, what if I wait here, and if no Catherine Gorgon shows up, then can you let me in instead of her? She'll have missed her chance, and I might be in luck for the job instead."
The guard sighed.
"Ah, here," he said. "I get enough of this at home."
"Enough of what?"
"I come to work to get away from this type of thing," he said.
"Away from what type of thing?"
"Go along in, and don't be annoying me,"
he said, practically pushing her through the doors.
"The wedding room is on the left there. Don't even think of going anywhere else, or I'll be after you faster than green grass through a goose."
"Charming,"
said my mother, slipping past him and walking towards the room he'd indicated. Stepping inside and sitting down, she looked around at the grandeur of the place and found that her heart was beating hard within her chest. A few minutes later, the door opened and a woman of about 50 entered, slender as a willow tree, with dark black hair that she wore cropped close to her head.
"Miss Goggin," she said, stepping forward. "I'm Charlotte Hennessy." "It's Mrs. Goggin, actually,"
said my mother quickly, standing up. And in a moment the expression on the older lady's face changed from friendly to disconcerted.
"Oh,"
she said, noticing my mother's belly.
"Oh, dear. It's a pleasure to meet you,"
said my mother.
"Thank you for taking the time. I hope the position is still available."
Mrs. Hennessy's mouth opened and shut several times like a fish, twisting back and forth on the deck of a boat until the life drained out of it.
"Mrs. Goggin,"
she said, her smile reasserting itself as she indicated that they should both sit down.
"It is still available, yes. But I am afraid there's been a misunderstanding." "Oh?"
said my mother.
"I was looking for a girl for the tea room, do you see? Not a married woman with a child on the way. We can't have married women here in Dáil Éireann. A married woman must be at home with her husband. Does your husband not work, no?" "My husband did work,"
said my mother, looking her full in the face and allowing her lower lip to tremble a little, a performance that she'd been practicing in the bathroom mirror all morning.
"And he's lost his position. I'm sorry, but there's still nothing that I can do for you. All our girls are single girls. Young girls like you, naturally, but unmarried. That's how the gentleman members prefer things." "He didn't lose his position, Mrs. Hennessy,"
said my mother, removing her handkerchief from her pocket and dabbing at her eyes.
"He lost his life." "Oh, my dear, I'm so sorry," said Mrs. Hennessy, a hand to her throat now in shock.
"The poor man."
"What happened to him, if you don't mind my asking?" The war happened to him, Miss Hennessy. The war? The war! He went over to fight just as his father had fought before him and his grandfather before that. The Germans got him. Less than a month ago now. A grenade ripped him to shreds. All I have left of him is his wristwatch and his false teeth. The lower set.
This was the story that she had concocted, and even in her own mind she knew it was a risky one, for there were those, many of whom worked in that very house, who thought poorly of Irishmen who went to fight for the British. But there was a heroic sound to the tale, and for whatever reason she had decided this was the way to go.
"You poor, unfortunate creature," said Mrs. Hennessy.
And when she reached out to squeeze my mother's hand, she knew that she was halfway home.
"And you in the family way. That is a tragedy." "If I had time to think of tragedies, it would be," said my mother. "But I can't afford to. That's the truth of it. I have this little one to think of," she added, placing a hand across her belly protectively. "You'll not believe this," said Mrs. Hennessy. "But the same thing happened to my Auntie Jocelyn during the First War. She'd been married to my Uncle Albert for only a year, and didn't he only sign up with the Brits and get himself killed at Passchendaele? The day she heard the news was the same day she found out that she was to have a child."
"Do you mind if I ask, Mrs. Hennessy?"
asked my mother, leaning forward.
"How did your Auntie Jocelyn cope? Was she all right in the end?"
"Oh, not a bother on her," declared Mrs. Hennessy. "You never met a woman like her for positivity. She just got on with things, didn't she? But then, that's what people did in those days. Great women, every one of them."
"Magnificent women, Miss Hennessy. I could probably learn a thing or two from your Auntie Jocelyn."
The older woman beamed in pleasure, but then her smile faded a little again.
"Still and all," she said, "I don't know if this could work. Do you mind if I ask how long you have to go?"
3 months,
said my mother.
3 months?
The job is full time. I'd expect you'd have to leave after the baby is born.
My mother nodded. Of course, she had her great plan, so knew that this wouldn't be the case. But here was her moment, and she was determined to seize it.
"Mrs. Hennessy," she said, "you seem like a kind woman.
You remind me of my late mother, who took care of me every day of her life until she succumbed to the cancer last year."
"Oh, my dear, your trials!"
"You have her kindness in your face, Miss Hennessy.
Let me cast aside all dignity now and throw myself on your mercy and make a suggestion.
I need a job, Mrs. Hennessy.
I need one badly so I can put money away for the child when he or she arrives, and I have almost nothing as it is. If you could find it in your heart to take me on for these next 3 months, then I will work like a cart horse for you and give you no cause to regret your decision. And when my time comes, perhaps you can advertise again and find a young girl who needs a chance then, just like I need a chance right now."
Mrs. Hennessy sat back, the tears forming in her eyes.
"I think of it now, and wonder why my mother was applying for a job in the Dáil at all, when she should have been across the Liffey giving an audition for Ernest Blythe."
"Your health?"
asked Mrs. Hennessy finally.
"Do you mind if I ask how your health is in general?"
"Tip-top,"
said my mother.
"I haven't had a day's illness in my life. Not even during these last 6 months."
Mrs. Hennessy sighed and looked around the walls, as if all the men represented there in gilt-edged frames could give her guidance. A portrait of W.T. Cosgrave hung over her shoulder, and he seemed to be glaring at my mother as if to say that he could see through every one of her lies, and if he could only wrench himself away from that canvas, he'd chase her out of the place with a stick.
"And the war's almost over,"
said my mother after a moment. A bit of a non sequitur, considering the conversation they were having.
"Did you hear that Hitler's after killing himself?
The future looks bright for us all."
Mrs. Hennessy nodded.
"I did hear, yes," she said with a shrug. "And good riddance to him,
if God will forgive me for saying so.
We'll all have better times ahead of us now, I hope.
A longer stay.
So it's up to the pair of you,
my mother told Sean and Smoot that night as they sat together in the brazen head, eating a good stew that they shared out between them from a ceramic tureen.
I can go next week when I get my first week's pay, or I can stay in the flat on Chatham Street until after the baby's born, and give you a third of what I earn in the meantime to cover my rent. I'd like to stay, as it's comfortable, and you're the only two people I know in Dublin. But you've been very good to me since I got here, and I don't want to outstay my welcome.
I don't mind, said Sean, smiling at her.
I'm happy as things are. But, of course, it's Jack's place, really, so it's up to him.
Smoot took a piece of bread from a plate in the centre of the table and dragged it around the rim of his bowl, not letting a single morsel of the stew go to waste. He put it in his mouth and chewed it carefully before swallowing, and then reached for his pint to wash it down.
Shall we put up with you this long, Kitty? He said. A few more months won't make much difference, I suppose.
The tea room.
The job in the Doll tea room was a lot more difficult than my mother had anticipated, and, perhaps appropriately considering the setting, each girl had to learn to be diplomatic in her dealings with the elected members. All day long, the TDs marched in and out in a fog of body odour and cigarette smoke, demanding a cream cake or an eclair to go with her cup of coffee, and rarely displaying any familiarity with manners. Some flirted with the girls, but didn't intend their teasing to lead anywhere. Others hoped that it would, and could become aggressive if they were thwarted. There were stories of girls who'd been seduced and then fired when the man grew weary of her. Stories of others who'd turned down an indecent proposal and been fired for that too. Once you caught the eye of a TD, it seemed that it could only lead in one direction, and that was towards the Dole queue. There were just 4 women elected to the Dole at the time, and my mother referred to them as the Maybes. Mary Reynolds from Sligo Leitrim and Mary Ryan from Tipperary, Bridget Redmond from Waterford, and Bridget Rice from Monaghan. And they were the worst of all, she said, for they didn't want to be seen speaking to the working girls, in case one of the men came over and asked them to warm their pot or help to sew a button back onto their shirt sleeve. Mr. De Valera didn't come in very often, she told me, as the tea was generally brought to him in his office by Mrs. Hennessy herself. But from time to time, he might pop his head in the door if he was looking for someone and take a seat with some of the backbenchers, gauging the mood of the party. Tall and skinny, a bit gormless-looking, she said, he was never anything but polite, and once reprimanded one of his own junior ministers for clicking his fingers at her, an action that earned him her eternal gratitude. The girls she worked alongside were full of concern for my mother's situation. 17 years old by now, with a fictitious husband dead in a war that had finally come to an end, and an all-too-real child ready to push its way out into the world, they regarded her with a mixture of fascination and pity.
"And your poor mammy died too, I heard,"
asked an older girl, Lizzie, as they stood by the sink one afternoon washing dishes.
"She did,"
said my mother.
"A terrible accident. I heard it was the cancer." "Oh, yes," she replied. "I meant a terrible misfortune that she got the cancer at all."
"They say it carries down the family line,"
said Lizzie, who must have been the life and soul of any party.
"Would you not worry that you'd get it yourself one day?" "Well, I hadn't thought about it before,"
said my mother, stopping what she was doing and considering it.
"But I'd think of nothing else now that you've said it."
For a moment, she told me, she wondered whether she might, in fact, be in danger of developing the disease, until she remembered that her mother, my grandmother, was alive and well and living with her husband and 6 straw-brained sons 230 miles away in Galeen, West Cork.
She relaxed again after that.
The Great Plan. In mid-August, Mrs. Hennessy called her into her office and said that she thought the time had come for my mother to leave the job.
"Is it because I was late this morning?"
asked my mother.
"It's the first time that's ever happened. But there was a man standing outside my front door as I was leaving,
and he had a look on his face that said he wanted to murder me. I didn't want to go out alone while he was still there. I went upstairs and looked out the window, and it was another 20 minutes before he turned on his heel and disappeared down Grafton Street.
"It's not because you were late," said Mrs. Hennessy, shaking her head.
"You've always been punctual, Catherine."
"Unlike some of them."
"No, I just think the time has come, that's all."
"But I still need the money," she protested.
"I have my rent to think of, and the child, and I know, and I feel for you. But would you take a look at yourself? You're as big as a house. You can't have more than a couple of days to go. Is there nothing stirring, no?"
"No," she said. "Not yet."
"The thing is," said Mrs. Hennessy, "I've had..."
"Would you sit down, Catherine, for God's sake, and take the weight off? You shouldn't be standing in your condition anyway."
"The thing is, I've had complaints from some of the TDs."
"About me?"
"About you."
"But I'm never anything other than polite.
Other than to that gombean man from Donegal, who presses against me every time he passes and calls me his cushion."
"Oh, I know that well enough,"
said Mrs. Hennessy. "Haven't I been watching you myself over these last 3 months?
You'd have a job for life here if it wasn't for, you know, the fact that you will have other responsibilities soon.
You're everything I look for in a tea girl. You were born to the role."
My mother smiled, deciding to take this as a compliment, even though she wasn't entirely sure that it was one.
"No, it's not your manners they're complaining about. It's your condition. They say that seeing a woman so far along in her pregnancy puts them off their custard slices."
"Are you having me on? This is what they've told me."
My mother laughed and shook her head.
"Who said these things?"
she asked.
"Will you name names, Mrs. Hennessy?"
"I won't, no.
Was it one of the maybes?"
"I won't say, Catherine."
"Party affiliation, then?"
"A little bit of both.
A few more of the Fianna Fáil crowd, though, if I'm honest. But you know what they're like. The blue shirts don't seem so bothered."
"Is it that little weasel that calls himself a minister for—"
"Catherine, I'm not going to get into specifics with you," insisted Mrs. Hennessy, holding a hand in the air to silence her.
"The fact is that you've only got days left anyway, a week at most, and it's in your best interest to stay off your feet. Would you not just do me the favour of calling it a day without any trouble about it? You've been wonderful, you have, and—"
"Of course," said my mother,
realizing that she would be better off not begging for more time.
"You've been very kind to me, Mrs. Hennessy. You gave me a job when I needed one, and I know it wasn't the easiest decision to make. I'll see out the day and leave with a special place in my heart for you."
Mrs. Hennessy breathed a sigh of relief and sat back in her chair.
"Thank you," she said. "You're a good girl, Catherine. You'll make a wonderful mother, you know. And if you ever need anything—" "Well, there is something, actually," she replied. "After the baby's born, could I come back, do you think?"
"Come back where? Come back here to the doll?"
"Oh, no, that wouldn't be possible. So who'd look after the baby, for one thing?"
My mother glanced out the window and took a deep breath.
This would be the first time she had spoken aloud of her great plan.
"His mother will look after him," she said. "Or her. Whichever it is."
"His mother?"
asked Mrs. Hennessy, baffled.
"But I won't be keeping the baby, Mrs. Hennessy,"
said my mother.
"It's all arranged. After I give birth, there's a little hunchbacked redemptorist nun who's going to come to the hospital to take the child away. A couple on Dartmouth Square are going to adopt it."
"Heavens above," said Mrs. Hennessy.
"And when was all this decided, if you don't mind my asking?"
"I decided on the day I found out that I was pregnant. I'm too young. I have no money, and there's no chance that I can provide for the child. I'm not heartless. I promise you that. But the baby will be better off if I give it to a family who can actually give it a good home."
"Well," replied Mrs. Hennessy, considering this, "I suppose these things do happen. But are you sure you'll be able to live with your decision?"
"No. But I think it's for the best, nevertheless. The child stands a better chance with them than it would with me. They have money, Mrs. Hennessy, and I haven't a bean.
And your husband? Is it what he would have wanted?
My mother couldn't bring herself to lie any more to this good woman, and perhaps the shame showed in her face.
Would I be right in thinking that there was no Mr. Goggin?
Mrs. Hennessy asked finally.
You would,
said my mother quietly.
And the wedding ring? I bought it myself, in a shop in Coppinger Row. I thought as much. No man would ever have the sense to choose something so elegant.
My mother looked up and smiled a little, and was surprised to see that Mrs. Hennessy was starting to cry, and she reached into her pocket for a handkerchief to pass across to her.
Are you all right?
She asked, surprised by this unexpected surge of emotion.
I'm fine, said Mrs. Hennessy.
Not a bother on me.
But you're crying. Only a little bit. Is it something I said?
Mrs. Hennessy looked up and swallowed hard.
Can we think of this room as akin to the confessional? She asked. And that what we say between each other stays in here? Of course, said my mother. You've been very kind to me. I hope you know that I have great affection and respect for you.
That's sweet of you to say. But I always guessed that the story you gave me wasn't quite true. And I wanted to show you the compassion that was never shown to me when I was in your position. Maybe you won't be surprised if I say that there was never a Mr. Hennessy either.
She extended her left hand, and they both looked at her wedding ring. I bought that for 4 shillings in a shop on Henry Street in 1913, she said. I haven't taken it off my finger since.
Do you have a child, too?
Asked my mother.
Did you have to bring it up alone?
Not quite, said Mrs. Hennessy hesitantly.
I'm from Westmeath. Did you know that, Catherine?
I did, yes. You told me once.
I haven't set foot in the place since I left. But I didn't come to Dublin to have my baby. I had it at home. In the bedroom I'd slept in every night of my life until then. The same room where the poor child was conceived.
And what happened to him? Asked my mother.
Was it a him? No, it was a her. A little girl. A beautiful little thing. She didn't last long.
Mammy cut the cord once she was out of me, and Daddy took her out the back, where a bucket of water was waiting, and he held her under for a minute or two, long enough to drown her. Then he threw her in a grave that he dug a few days earlier and covered her over, and that was the end of that. No one ever knew. Not the neighbours.
Not the priest.
Not the Gardaí.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph,
said my mother, sitting back in horror.
I never even got a chance to hold her, said Mrs. Hennessy. Mammy cleaned me up and I was put onto the road later that same day. They said I was never to return.
I was denounced from the pulpit, said my mother. The parish priest called me a whore.
Those fellas have no more sense than a wooden spoon, said Mrs. Hennessy. I've never known cruelty like the cruelty of the priests. This country... She closed her eyes and shook her head, and my mother said that it looked like she wanted to scream.
That's a terrible story,
said my mother eventually. I suppose the baby's daddy didn't offer to marry you. Mrs. Hennessy gave a bitter laugh.
He wouldn't have been able anyway, she said. He was already married.
Did his wife find out?
Mrs. Hennessy stared at her, and when she spoke, her voice was low and mixed with shame and loathing.
She knew well enough, she said. Didn't I tell you that she cut the cord?
My mother said nothing for a moment, and when she finally realized what Mrs. Hennessy meant, she put a hand to her mouth and felt that she might be sick.
As I said, these things happen, said Mrs. Hennessy.
Your decision is made, Catherine? You're going to give up the child?
My mother couldn't find her voice, but nodded.
Then give yourself a couple of weeks afterwards to get better, and then come back to me. We'll tell people that the baby died, and soon enough they'll forget all about it.
Will that work?
Asked my mother.
It will work for them,
she replied, reaching over and taking my mother's hand in hers.
But I'm sorry to say, Catherine, it will never work for you.
Violence.
It was growing dark as my mother made her way home that evening. Turning the corner onto Chatham Street, she was annoyed to notice a figure emerging unsteadily from Clarendon's pub, the same man whose presence outside her door that morning had made her late for work. He was wildly overweight, with a wrinkled face gone red with the drink and 2 or 3 days' growth of beard that gave him the appearance of a vagrant.
"There you are now," he said,
as she walked towards her front door, the stench of whiskey on his breath so strong that she was forced to pull back from him.
"Large as life and twice as ugly."
She said nothing, but took the key from her pocket, and in her anxiety she struggled to insert it correctly.
"There's rooms up above, isn't there?"
asked the man, glancing up towards the window.
"A rake of them, or just the one?"
"Just the one," she said. "So if you're looking for lodgings, I'm afraid you've come to the wrong place."
"The accent on you. You sound Cork-born to me. Where are you from? Bantry? Drimmeleague?" "I knew a lass once from Drimmeleague. A worthless creature who went with any man who asked her."
My mother looked away and tried the key again, cursing beneath her breath as it jammed in the lock, causing her to twist the metal violently to release it.
"If you could just step out of the light," she asked,
turning to look at him in the eye.
"Just the one flat,"
he said, scratching his chin as he considered this.
"Oh, you live with them, do you?"
"With who?"
"That's a curious arrangement altogether."
"With who?"
she insisted.
"With the queer fellas, of course. But what would they want with you, anyway? They've no use for a woman, either of them."
He stared at her belly and shook his head.
"Did one of them do this?" "No, sir, they wouldn't have it in them. You probably don't even know who's responsible, do you, you dirty little slut?"
My mother turned back to the door, and this time the key slid in easily and the lock released. Before she could step inside, however, he pushed past her and marched into the hallway, leaving her standing on the street, uncertain what to do. It was only when he began to make his way up the staircase that she regained control of her senses and grew angry at the intrusion.
"Get down here, you!" she called up to him. "This is a private residence, do you hear me? I'll call the Gardaí."
"Or whoever the fuck you like,"
he roared back. And she looked up and down the street, but there wasn't a sinner in sight. Gathering all her courage, she followed him up the staircase, where he was rattling ineffectively at the door handle.
"Open this now,"
he said, pointing a fat finger at her, and she couldn't help but notice the dirt that lived beneath his long fingernails. A farmer, she decided, and his accent was Cork too, but not West Cork, or she would have been able to identify it quickly.
"Open it now, little girl, or I'll put my foot right through it."
"I will not," she said. "And you leave these premises, or I'll—"
He turned his back on her, waving her away, and as good as his word, lifted his right boot, gave the door an almighty kick, and it burst open, slamming against the wall and causing a pot to fall from a shelf into the bathtub with a terrific clatter. The living room was empty, but even as he stumbled inside, with my mother in hot pursuit, the sound of anxious voices could be heard from the bedroom beyond.
"Get out here, son McIntyre,"
roared the man, reeling in his drunkenness.
"Get out here now till I bait some decency into you. I warned you what I'd do if I ever caught the pair of you together again."
He lifted his stick. My mother hadn't even noticed the stick until that moment, and brought it down solidly against the table a few times, hard enough to make her jump at the noise of it. Her own father had a stick just like this one, and many was the time she had observed him set upon one of her brothers with it in a fury. He had tried to use it on her on the night that her secret was revealed, but
Mercifully, my grandmother had held him back.
"You have the wrong place," cried my mother. "This is madness."
"Get out here," roared the man again. "Get out here or I'll come in there and get you myself. Come on now."
"Leave,"
said my mother, pulling at his sleeve. But he pushed her away violently, causing her to fall against the armchair, whereupon a swift pain coursed through her back and ran along the length of her spine, like a mouse scurrying for cover. The man reached for the bedroom door, flinging it wide open. And there, to my mother's astonishment, were Sean and Smoot, naked as the day they were born, sitting up against the headboard of the bed, expressions of utter terror on their faces.
"Jesus Christ,"
said the man, turning away in disgust.
"Get out here now, you dirty little bastard."
"Daddy,"
said Sean, jumping from the bed, and my mother couldn't help but stare at his naked body as he rushed to cover himself with trousers and shirt.
"Daddy, please, let's just go downstairs and—"
He stepped into the living room, but before he could say another word, the man, his own father, grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and smashed his head hard against the one shelf that stood affixed to the wall and carried only three books, a Bible, a copy of Ulysses, and a biography of Queen Victoria. There was a terrible sound, and Sean let out a groan that seemed to emerge from the very depths of his being. And when he turned around, his face was pale, and a black mark stood out on his forehead, pulsating for a moment as if uncertain what was expected of it, before turning red as the blood began to pour. His legs gave way beneath him, and as he collapsed to the ground, the man reached down and dragged him with one hand towards the doorway, where he began to kick him repeatedly, beating him with his stick and issuing blasphemies with every fresh assault.
"Get off him!"
cried my mother, throwing herself on the man as Smoot emerged from the bedroom with a hurley stick, a red-and-white sticker affixed to it showing two towers and a ship sailing between them, and charged towards their attacker. He hadn't put a stitch of clothes on, and even in the drama of the moment my mother was shocked by the hair that covered his torso, so unlike the chests of Sean, my father, or any of her brothers, and the long, still glistening manhood that shook between his legs as he advanced on them. The man roared as the hurley hit him in the back, but it was an ineffective blow, and he pushed Smoot away with such force that the younger man fell backwards over the sofa and into the doorway of the bedroom beyond, where, she realized now, the boys had been lovers since the day the bus had arrived in Dublin from Cork. She had heard of such people. The boys in school made fun of them all the time. Was it any wonder, she asked herself, that Smoot had never wanted her there? It was to be their love place. That was it. And she was the cuckoo in their nest.
"Jack!"
cried my mother, as Padder McIntyre, for that was the man's name, took his son by the head once more and kicked his body with such barbarous force that she could hear the sounds of ribs cracking.
"Sean!"
she screamed. But when the boy's head twisted towards her, his eyes were wide open, and she knew that he had already departed this world for the next. Still and all, she would not allow more injury to come to him, and ran back across the room, determined to pull the man away. But with her first attempt, he took her by an arm and, in a quick movement, gave her a mighty kick that sent her through the open doorway and tumbling down the staircase, each step, she told me later, making her feel an inch closer to death herself. Landing with a crash on the ground below, she lay on her back for a moment, staring up at the ceiling, gasping for breath. Inside her belly, I protested strongly at the insult and decided that my time had come, and my mother let out a ferocious scream as I broke free of the womb and began my first journey. Pulling herself to her feet, she looked around. Another woman in her position might have opened the front door and thrown herself out onto Chatham Street roaring for help, but not Catherine Goggin. Sean was dead. She was certain of that. But Smoot was still up there, and she could hear him pleading for his life, and then the sounds of violence, the screams of pain, the curses that lashed down on the boy's head as Sean's father attacked him too. Crying out with every movement, she dragged herself up the first step, another and another, until she had ascended halfway. She screamed as I made my presence felt,
and there was something in her mind, she told me later, that said, I had waited 9 months, I could wait another 9 minutes. She continued her climb, entering the flat with perspiration running down her face, water and blood seeping down her legs, frightened by the image of the madwoman in the mirror opposite with the bedraggled hair, split lip and torn dress. From the room beyond, Smoot's cries were growing less pronounced as the kicks and the whips of the stick continued, and she stepped over Sean's body, glancing quickly at the open eyes on his once beautiful face, and had to stop herself from crying out in grief. "I'm on my way," I thought, as she moved forward purposefully, looking around the room for a weapon before her eyes landed on the hurley that Smoot had dropped onto the floor. "Are you ready for me?" One swift swing was all it took, God love her, and Padder McIntyre lay knocked out. Not dead. He would live for 8 more years, in fact, eventually choking on a fishbone in his local pub. The jury, having set him free, finding that his crime had been committed under the extreme provocation of having a mentally disordered son, but unconscious. And my mother and I threw ourselves down on Smoot's body. The poor lad's face muddled with the beating, his breath disordered, close enough to death now, too. "Jack!" she cried, cradling his face in her lap, and then letting out a blood-curdling shriek as everything in her being told her to push. To push now, and my head began to emerge from between her legs.
"Jack, stay with me. Don't die. Do you hear me, Jack? Don't die."
"Kitty,"
said Smoot, the word muffled as it emerged from his mouth, along with a couple of broken teeth.
"And don't fucking call me Kitty,"
she roared, screaming once again as more of my body squeezed itself out into the August night.
"Kitty,"
he whispered, his eyes beginning to close, and she shook him as the pain racked through her body.
"You have to live, Jack,"
she cried.
"You have to live!"
And then she must have passed out. For silence was restored to the room until a minute later, when I took advantage of the peace and quiet to push the rest of my tiny body onto the filthy carpet of the upstairs flat on Chatham Street, in a bundle of blood and placenta and slime. I waited a few moments to gather my thoughts before opening my lungs for the first time, and with an almighty roar, one that must have been heard by the men in the pub below, who came running up the staircase to discover the cause of such a racket, announced to the world that I had arrived, that I was born, that I was part of it all at last. 1952. The vulgarity of popularity. One little girl in a pale pink coat. I first met Julian Woodbead when his father called to the house on Dartmouth Square to discuss ways to keep his most valuable client out of prison. Max Woodbead was a solicitor, a very good one by all accounts, with an insatiable desire to mix in the highest echelons of Dublin society and an office on Ormond Quay close to the forecourts. From his window he enjoyed a view across the Liffey towards Christ Church Cathedral, and liked to claim, somewhat unconvincingly, that whenever he heard the bells ring, he would fall to his knees and say a prayer to the late Pope Benedict XV, who had ascended to the throne of St. Peter on that same September day in 1914 that he was born. My adoptive father had hired him after a series of misadventures concerning, but not limited to, gambling, women, fraud, tax evasion, and an assault on a journalist from the Dublin Evening Mail. The Bank of Ireland, where my father held a prominent position as director of investments and client portfolios, had no particular rules about how its employees spent their time when they were not at their desks, but they took a dim view of the bad publicity that he was bringing their way. In recent months, he had been seen gambling thousands of pounds at Leopardstown races, been photographed coming out of the Shelburne Hotel with a prostitute at 4 o'clock in the morning, fined for urinating over the side of the Happeny Bridge while he was in his cups, and given an interview on Radio Erin in which he said that the country's finances would be in a better position if the Brits had shot the Minister for Finance, Sean McEntee,
after the Easter Rising, as they'd originally planned to do. He'd also been castigated for attempting to kidnap a 7-year-old boy in Grafton Street, a trumped-up charge, as he had simply taken him by the hand and dragged him across to Trinity College under the impression that the frightened child, who shared my height and hair colour but was unfortunately a mute, was me. An affair with an actress of some renown was suggested by the Irish press, who made their disapproval clear by reprimanding him for extramarital shenanigans with a lady of the theatre, when his own wife, who our more literary readers might know, has some small celebrity of her own, is recovering from a distressing bout of cancer of the ear canal. The upshot was that the Department of Revenue launched a formal investigation into my father's accounts and, to no one's surprise, discovered that he had been cheating on his tax returns for years to the tune of more than £30,000. Immediate suspension from the bank followed, and the man from the Revenue announced that he intended to use the full power of the judicial system to make an example of him, at which point Max Woodbead inevitably was called. Of course, when I say my father, I don't mean the man who handed 2 green pound notes to my mother outside the Church of Our Lady, Star of the Sea in Gulleen 7 years earlier to soothe his conscience. No, I mean Charles Avery, who, along with his wife Maud, opened their home to me after signing a sizable cheque to the Redemptorist Convent for all their help in the matter of finding a suitable child. From the start, they never pretended to be anything other than my adoptive parents, and, in fact, schooled me in this detail from the time I could first understand the meaning of the words. Maud claimed that this was because she didn't want the truth to come out at a later date, and for me then to accuse her of deceit, while Charles insisted that it was because he wanted to be clear that, while he was happy to go through with the adoption for his wife's sake, I was not a real Avery, and would not be looked after financially in adulthood in the manner that a real Avery would have been. "Think of this more as a tenancy, Cyril," he told me. They had named me Cyril for a spaniel they'd once owned and loved. "An 18-year tenancy. But during that time there's no reason why we shouldn't all get along, is there? Though if I had a son of my own, I'd like to think he would have been taller than you and shown a little more skill on the rugby field. But I suppose you're not the worst. God only knows whom we might have got. Do you know, at one point there was even a suggestion that we take in an African baby?" The relationship between Charles and Maud was cordial and businesslike. They had little to do with each other most days, exchanging no more than a few cursory sentences necessary to the efficient running of the household. Charles left every morning at 8 o'clock, and rarely returned before midnight, when he invariably spent a minute or two on the porch, trying to fit his key into the lock, and not caring if he reeked of drink or cheap perfume. They didn't sleep in the same room, or even on the same floor, nor had they ever done so since my arrival. I never once saw them hold hands, or kiss, or say that they loved each other. But for all that, they never fought. Maud's way of dealing with Charles was to treat him like an ottoman, of no use to anyone but worth having around. While Charles showed scant interest in his wife, but found her presence both reassuring and unsettling, much like Mr. Rochester must have felt towards Bertha Mason as she rattled around the attic of Thornfield Hall, a relic from his past that remained an inexorable part of his daily life. They had no children of their own, of course. An early and vivid memory is of Maud confiding in me that there had been a little girl once, a year after she and Charles were married. But she had endured a difficult labour, and not only had the child, Lucy, died, but a subsequent operation meant that she would not be able to get pregnant again. "A blessed relief in so many ways, Cyril," she remarked, lighting a cigarette and staring out into the fenced park at the centre of Dartmouth Square, on the lookout for intruders. She loathed non-residents appearing in the gardens, despite the fact that they were, strictly speaking, public property, and was known for rapping on the window panes and shooing them away like dogs. "There is simply nothing more disgusting than the naked body of a man. All that hair and such terrible smells, because men don't know how to wash themselves properly unless they've been in the army. And their secretions,
which seep forth from their appendages when aroused, are repellent. You're lucky that you will never have to endure the indignity of relations with the male member. The vagina is a much purer instrument. I feel an admiration for the vagina that I simply have never felt towards the penis.
If I recall correctly, I was around 5 years old when she passed this piece of wisdom on to me. Perhaps it was because both Charles and Maud spoke to me in such an adult manner, apparently forgetting or failing to notice that I was just a child, that my own vocabulary grew quicker than other children's my age. Maud had a career of her own, for she was the author of a number of literary novels, published by a small press in Dorky. A new one appeared every few years to positive reviews, but minuscule sales, something that pleased her enormously, for she considered popularity in the bookshops to be vulgar. In this endeavour, Charles was never anything but supportive, and rather enjoyed introducing her as "my wife, the lady novelist Maud Avery." Never read a word of her work myself, but God bless her, she keeps on churning them out. She wrote all day, every day, even Christmas Day, and rarely emerged from her study except to prowl around the house in a haze of cigarette smoke, looking for boxes of matches. Why she wanted to adopt a child at all is a mystery to me, as she showed no interest whatsoever in my well-being, although she was never actively unkind or cruel. However, I couldn't help but feel deprived of affection, and once, when I came home in tears to tell her that one of my school friends, the boy who sat next to me in Latin class, and with whom I often ate my lunch, had been run over and killed by a bus on Parnell Square, she simply remarked that it would be ghastly if anything like that happened to me, as they had gone to so much trouble to find me in the first place.
"You weren't the first one, you know," she said,
lighting another cigarette and taking a long drag as she counted off the babies on her left hand.
"There was a girl in Wicklow to whom we paid a sizable amount of money, but when the baby was born it had a peculiar-shaped head, and I simply hadn't the energy. And then there was another in Rathmines who we took on approval for a few days, but the baby just cried all the time, and I couldn't bear it, so we sent her back. And then Charles said he would accept no more girls, only a boy. And so I was stuck with you, darling."
I was never hurt by these types of remarks, for she didn't mean them maliciously. It was simply her way of speaking, and, having never known anything different, I accepted that I was just a living creature who shared a house with two adults who rarely acknowledged each other. I was fed, clothed, and schooled, and to complain would have shown a level of ingratitude that probably would have baffled them both. Only when I reached an age where I was old enough to understand fully the concept of natural and adoptive parents did I break one of our home's golden rules and enter Maud's study uninvited to inquire as to the identities of my real mother and father. When I located her through the miasma and managed to clear my throat enough to speak, she simply shook her head in bewilderment, as if I had asked her to tell me the distance to the nearest mile between the Jumeirah Mosque in Nairobi and the Todga Gorge in Morocco.
"For heaven's sake, Cyril," she said, "that was 7 years ago. How on earth would I recall? Your mother was a girl, I know that much."
"And what happened to her?" I asked.
"Is she alive?"
"How should I know?"
"Don't you even remember her name?"
"It was probably Mary. Aren't most Irish country girls called Mary?"
"So she wasn't from Dublin?"
I asked, seizing on this piece of information like a tiny nugget of gold discovered at the heart of a placer deposit.
"I really couldn't tell you. I never met her, never communicated with her, and never knew the first thing about her, other than the fact that she had allowed a man to engage in carnal relations with her, resulting in a child, that child being you. Now look, Cyril, can't you see that I'm writing? You know you're not supposed to come in here when I'm at work. I lose my train of thought if I'm interrupted."
I always called them Charles and Maud, never father and mother. This was on Charles's insistence, as I wasn't a real Avery. It didn't bother me particularly, but I know it made other people uncomfortable, and once, in school, when I referred to them thus, a priest punched me around the ears and told me off for being modern. I faced two problems at an early age, one of which might have been the natural result of the other.
I was cursed with a stutter that seemed to have a mind of its own. It would be there some days and disappear on others. And it had the ability to drive both my adoptive parents to distraction. It stayed with me until the age of 7, when, on the same day that I met Julian Woodbead, it vanished forever. How these two events are connected remains a mystery to me, but the damage to my confidence was already done, and I found myself painfully shy, nervous of most of my classmates, with the exception of that one child who had been squashed beneath the wheels of the number 16 bus. Horrified by the prospect of speaking in public, and simply incapable of conversing with anyone lest my affliction rear its head and cause people to laugh at me. It bothered me greatly, for I was not by nature a solitary person, and I longed for a friend, someone to play games with or share my secrets. Occasionally Charles and Maud would host a dinner party where they would come together as husband and wife. And on such occasions I would be brought down and passed around from couple to couple like a Fabergé egg they purchased from a descendant of the last Russian Tsar. "His mother was a fallen woman," Charles liked to say, "and we, in an act of Christian charity, took him in and gave him a home, a little hunchback redemptress nun brought him to us. If you ever want a child, the nuns are the people to call, that's what I say. There's plenty of them. I don't know where they keep them all or how they get them in the first place, but there's never a shortage. Introduce yourself to our guests, Cyril." And I would look around the room, at 6 or 7 couples dressed in the most extraordinary clothes, bedecked with jewellery, each of whom stared at me as if they expected me to sing a song, perform a dance, or pull a rabbit out of my ear. "Entertain us," their expression said. "If you can't entertain us, then what is the point of you anyway?" But in my anxiety, I would be unable to utter a word, and I would simply look down at the ground and perhaps start crying. And then Charles would wave me away and remind the room that I wasn't his son at all, not really. When the scandal broke, I was 7 years old and became aware of it due to the comments of my classmates, most of whose fathers worked in similar environments to Charles, and who took great pleasure in telling me that he was for the high jump and would surely be jailed before the year was out. "He's not my father," I would point out, unable to look any of them in the eye and clenching and unclenching my fists in anger. "He's my adoptive father." I had been trained well. Intrigued by the things that were being said about him, however, I began to scour the newspapers for information, and although they were careful not to publish a libel, it was clear that Charles, like the Archbishop of Dublin, was a man much feared, much admired, and much hated. And, of course, there was no shortage of rumours. He was regularly to be found in the company of both the Anglo-Irish aristocracy and the ne'er-do-wells of the city. On any given night, he could be discovered throwing 10-pound notes down on the tables of illicit gambling halls. He had murdered his first wife, Emily. "Was there a first wife?" I asked once of Maud. "Oh, yes, now that you mention it. I think there was," she replied. He had made and lost his fortune thrice over. He was an alcoholic and had cigars sent on a cargo ship from Cuba by Fidel Castro himself. He had 6 toes on his left foot. He had once had an affair with Princess Margaret. There was an endless supply of stories regarding Charles, and there may even have been truth to some of them. So perhaps it was inevitable that one day the services of Max Woodbead would be required. Things had to be in a bad way for that to happen, and even Maud had begun to emerge from her study occasionally to wander around the house muttering dark asides about the man from the revenue, as if he might be found hiding under the stairs or stealing her emergency supply of cigarettes from the bread bin in the kitchen. On the day that Max showed up, I hadn't spoken to a single person in 8 days. I'd kept note of it in a diary. I hadn't raised my hand in class, hadn't said a word to anyone in school, had eaten my meals in perfect silence, which was how Maud preferred it anyway, and generally hid away in my bedroom, wondering what was wrong with me. For even at that tender age, I knew that there was something about me that was different, and that would be impossible ever to put right. I would have stayed in my bedroom that day.
I was reading Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson, had it not been for the scream. It came from the second floor where Maud's study was located, and echoed around the house in such a fashion that I assumed someone was dead. Running out to the landing, I peered